For the week of April 29th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 408, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Welcome back, Sperling.
Thank you very much.
You were at CinemaCon and so much happened while you were gone.
Really? What happened?
Everything happened. Sprint and T-Mobile are merging. They're going to try to become one company. If the government will approve, they'll have 100 million customers. There will be just be three major carriers in the United States battling for your cell phone dollar. And, you know, because they're merging, I felt like it's time we should share that we too are merging. Showbiz Sandbox is merging with This American Life and become one big podcast. We haven't told them yet, but it's going to be very exciting, and we feel like it's going to be good for everyone.
Now, you're saying we haven't told our listeners or This American Life? Because I think it's both.
Anybody. That's okay. Right. We haven't told anybody. But are you an Amazon Prime member?
I am an Amazon Prime member. But now I feel unspecial. Before, I thought I was like the most special person. I had like the biggest secret. I could get items delivered from Amazon in 2 days. And I got all this free video stuff. But now I found out I'm like one of 100 million people.
And you're going to pay more for the privilege.
Yes, but you know, when you look at it, it's like $120 instead of $100. You know what? Okay, fine.
That's a big jump. That's a 20% increase. But when you break it down, it means you're paying $10 a month. You like $10 a month for free shipping? Only if you buy a lot of stuff. Is there enough on Amazon Prime with the TV shows that you would pay $10 a month if that was all you got?
Just no. Amazon Prime?
Yeah, just the video. Just the video.
Just the video? You know, there are a couple shows that, you know, because they get the AMC content. So it's not just, Amazon Prime's content, but they get all of their own movies that they produce.
You would pay for Amazon Video just on its own?
Probably not. I don't pay for Hulu.
Would you pay for Amazon Music on their own?
I don't now.
Do you buy enough stuff shipping?
Yes.
Okay. So you're just happy to get all that stuff as a bonus?
Correct.
And that's the idea, isn't it?
Yes, they could care less whether they make money. I mean, I'm sure they care whether they make money. But as far as making money off of Amazon Prime, it's kind of like a loss leader to me.
No. Amazon Prime is where they're making the money. The video is the loss leader.
That's
what I'm saying. The music is the loss leader. Oh, okay. You said Amazon Prime.
Sorry.
Yeah, the video offering and the music offering is the loss leader. And then just like books, you know, they do a lot of book publishing, not just self-publishing. And in fact, Amazon has just signed, what is his name? His name is Chetan Bhagat.
So you did all of that to mispronounce somebody's name?
Yes, it's Chetan Bhagat. Or I looked up on YouTube, or Chetan Bhagat. I heard multiple pronunciations of his name. That's why I'm so unsure. But he's a huge name in India literature, perhaps the best-selling contemporary author in the entire country. And that's a big one. And Amazon Publishing snapped him up from his current Indian publisher. So, you know, they're not messing around. It's as if they signed, you know, Stephen King here in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's a big, big get for them. So that's just one more example of someone that they want on part of their home. They want people to feel like, you know, they get extra access to him, and they hopefully will keep paying their $20, $10 a month for Amazon Prime.
Well, I'm going to check out that author now. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I assume he'll be available here all over the world as well. So you're checking him out, and Chetan, I'm sure, will be checking out Showbiz Sandbox. And when they does, what will he hear about this week?
You know, before we talk about this week, let's talk about next week. And not because, you know...
Is there a show next week?
That's why I wanted to talk about that. I don't know how we're going to pull this off, because I'm going to be traveling on the day that we normally record the show.
Oh, to Con.
Yes. I don't know how we're going to do this.
We could record the night before, but then you'll never have time to edit it.
Yeah, we'll have to figure something out. We'll figure something out for next week's show. But in the meantime, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about CinemaCon, the overstuffed event that really needs to stretch out for another day or two. I saw teasers for a bunch of upcoming films, but the looming introduction of LED screens was the big story. Just a year or two after exhibitors finally switched to digital projectors, they're being asked to ditch them and spend a lot more money on LED. Is it worth it? And will it happen? Meanwhile, our podcast took a week off, but MoviePass never sleeps. They introduced new rules for users, dumped the one movie a day offering, perhaps forever, by the way, became a hot button topic at CinemaCon, and demanded new members pledge to donate their firstborn child to the company. Okay, that's not true. yet, but they seem determined to gain more users while reducing the appeal of MoviePass as much as possible. During Book Filter, Michael will discuss a dip in the ebook format, the sale of the UK chain Waterstones, and offer up not one, but two new books perfect for TV. In sexual misconduct news, Bill Cosby was found guilty. Stan Lee and journalist Tom Brokaw were accused of sexual misconduct, and a Telugu actress wants to bring Me Too to the Indian film industry. On Inside Baseball, we've got a lot more on the battle royale between the Writers Guild and talent agencies. It's going to get ugly. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office, or as we're now naming this segment, what has Marvel made this week?
We're looking at box office around the world, and so is everybody else this week, because the number one movie is The Avengers Infinity War Part 1. It opened almost everywhere, not China, but almost every country. $640 million worldwide. Mic drop.
Well, here's a question for you, because I'm looking at just the domestic. On Sunday, it was $250 million. Now I see it's $258 million. Did they find $8 million just lying around somewhere?
Well, they were being slightly conservative. You know, they're always estimating on Saturday and Sunday what's happening. They're really good. But, you know, the movie played very well. And so the domestic total is a record opening weekend of $258 million. The worldwide opening is a record of $640 million. The international opening is not a record. Fast and Furious still has the record for that because it opened up in China where it made $185 million on that opening weekend. So The Avengers Infinity War has multiple records all over the world. So, you know, it's going to be fine in terms of, you know, setting those records and having a lot to brag about. But is it going to be profitable? It is estimated the movie costs $300 to $400 million. And when you look at the number of stars in it, that's not hard to imagine. But what I don't know and can't figure out is how much of that is divided between each part. You know, is it $300 million for this one and $300 million for part two? Is it $400 million for this one? Is it $400 million for both of them? So I'm not sure. The budget's not well reported. Obviously, the studio hasn't come out and said, this is what it cost. So, you know, I don't know. If it costs $400 million, they're going to triple their budget. You know, they're going to make $1.2 billion. That's clearly obvious. But exactly how profitable they are. If they spent $800 million to make two movies, that's a lot of money. You need to make $2.4 billion to come out ahead.
Yeah, well, and that would also make that the most, them, you know, no way did they spend $800 million making two movies. I think I mean, that would make each one of those one of the most expensive movies ever produced.
Well, there's 30 stars in it who are, you know, I mean, $300 million doesn't surprise you, though, does it? We've got movie after movie that costs $200 to $250 million.
Yeah, I guess. I could see them spending $500 million to produce both movies.
Yeah, I would think it would be something more like that. $500 million to make both of them. You've got deals with the actors and say, all right, look, you know, this is what you're going to get. We're going to shoot both at once. You're going to get this amount of money. And then Robert Downey Jr. gets a truckload and so on. But we don't really know. But we do know it's made a lot of money on opening weekend. Fans were happy. Everything's going to be fine. It's a great start to the second quarter. We're in the second quarter now, right?
Yes. Now, let me tell you something. No matter what this movie makes, you know, I mean, granted, if it made a dollar, yes, that would be a problem. But we already know it's successful. We already know it's a blockbuster. And it's a Disney film, right? So they get to, you know, kind of capitalize on this on their properties, their intellectual property and their franchise at theme parks and merchandise and elsewhere. So they're sitting pretty. They're fine.
Yeah, absolutely. The $4 billion they spent for Marvel looks like money well spent. And that was at a time when Marvel, you know, you would have thought they were valuable properties, but, you know, nobody was running around saying, let's make a Thor movie. Let's make an Iron Man movie. Let's make a Black Panther movie. These were not slam dunks.
No, they had two movies down at that point. Yes, Spider-Man was over at Sony and X-Men was over at Fox. And they
but
had
those
proven.
Were the big prop. Those were the big ones. Those right. were the ones you were excited by. Captain America looks dorky. He's World War II. You know, it was not a slam dunk. So full credit to them.
No, and at CinemaCon, which I know we'll talk about later, when Disney gave their presentation, they kind of laid out all the posters for all, like, I think it's 14 movies over the past 10 years. 19 movies. Good grief. I thought, wow, they have really captured the comic book aesthetic, you know, with all those like drawn posters. I was like, you know, good on them that they were able to do that.
Well, as someone said, you know, now's the time to realize also that the mistakes of the comic book industry of Marvel and DC, when they have all these crossover episodes and build to a big epic finale when a special series of comic book is like, you know, you go to that well too often. You know, when you make movies that don't stand on their own, you know, we watched Captain America Civil War. It was, you know, it would have made no sense if you hadn't seen the movies that came before and the movies that came after. And that's fine. It worked this time. But you don't necessarily want to repeat that again with the next 10 or 15 movies.
Now, let me ask you something. Did you see Avengers Infinity War?
I have not seen it yet. I was going to probably go on Wednesday, which is my birthday.
Ooh, happy birthday.
That's right. And if you want to wish me a happy birthday, do so by going to iTunes.
Well, what would you do at iTunes? Would you rate and review the show? Because you can do that. If you can rate, review Showbiz Sandbox and subscribe to it on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, or anywhere they give podcasts away for free.
That's right. Yeah, please do that. It means a lot to us. Means a lot to me on my birthday. Wouldn't that be nice? I mentioned that was the beginning of the second quarter. That's because we have some stats. Ticket prices in North America reached a new record high of $9.16 in the first quarter. At the same time, ticket sales fell another 6% from the first quarter from 1 year earlier. So ticket prices, record high, ticket sales continuing to fall. Maybe they should draw a lesson from that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was trying to do some math and figure out, you know, how is it that Avengers Infinity War beats out something as you know, anticipated as Star Wars The Force Awakens in its domestic opening. And I guess Star Wars The Force Awakens opened to $247 million.
That's hardly past, you know, not like it slammed it to the wall. that's very close.
Yeah, it came very close. And I started to say, well, wait a second. Did it come maybe 3.7% within that range? Because if so, then it's ticket prices that are up.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at some of the movies, clearly all the Marvel movies have done well. But that criticism really stuck with me. The sense of like, you know, you've done this interlocking thing. That's fine. You don't necessarily want to do it going forward. And all the movies have been a hit practically. Virtually almost every one has probably been profitable for sure. But, you know, when you look at the individual titles, I feel like the standalone ones seem to stand out a little bit. I mean, I guess it's not true because they all do well, but you go, you know what? Guardians did really well. Doctor Strange did really well. Ant-Man did really well. Black Panther did really well. I feel like, you know, don't get Deadpool. So excited by making every movie have to continue the story of the movie before. Don't get so overwhelmed with that next time around.
Well, I know a lot of comic book fans, some who were Marvel junkies, were disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
They just felt like, boy, that's depressing.
Yeah. What? What was depressing?
This particular film.
Oh, because of the plot reveal?
Yeah, which we're not going to get into.
They thought it was not quality.
Yes, correct.
Oh, they thought it was a poor movie. Well, our in-house critic, Aaron Rich, was pleasantly surprised. He thought it was pretty funny. You know, it's what it is, you know, just a right. Big spectacle. But he felt it was sort of a nimble to a degree. But that's the number one movie around the world, and it's not the only story. There's a big one at number two, and I heard about the tracking on this movie. And they were in China press. They were talking about, whoa, it's going to be a record all-time romantic drama. I'm like, what? It hasn't even opened yet. But here we go. Us and Them, directed by Taiwanese star Renee Leo, a.k.a. Milk Tea, as I like to call her. This movie, this drama, opened up to $88 million. It is a romantic drama about two strangers who meet on a train during Chunyun. That's the annual migration of people who go home for Chinese New Year. A couple things confuse me here. One, why wasn't this movie released in February when that's exactly what everyone was doing? Why was it released now? But two, is this a Chinese film? I'm not sure if this is Chinese or Taiwanese, but it is a Taiwanese pop star, Renee Leo, and this movie has been embraced in China. So that's very exciting to see since there is tension between those two countries. She is a big, big pop star, lots of big albums. She's an award-winning actress, and now she's making her directorial debut with an $88 million opening. I don't know what the budget is for this film, but it's nowhere near that much.
No, it's definitely not $88 million.
We're looking at female stars coming into their own and becoming directors. Here's another huge, huge success story. Unless I'm mistaken, this is the biggest opening weekend. What did Wonder Woman open at? This may be the biggest opening weekend of all time in a single territory for a female director. So that's no matter what happens, Milk Tea has had a big, big success here. That's very exciting to see. And number three around the world is Rampage, the Dwayne Johnson film that had its legs cut out from under it because of the Avengers, at least here in America. But it's still making money around the world, $23 million on the weekend, $330 million worldwide. So it's going to be just fine. And number four, the John Krasinski horror film, A Quiet Place, $17 million on the weekend, $235 million worldwide. And there will be a sequel. In the sequel, you have to be really loud. You have to talk loudly all the time. I would be safe. And number five is A or B. This is a crime thriller of some sort. I think it's Chinese, but God forgive me, I'm not quite sure. It opened to $15 million. I really couldn't find out much about that movie. We've already told you how to reach out to us, but if you know something about A or B, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
At number six is Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One, another $11 million on the weekend, $545 million worldwide. So the film is safe, but I have to feel like it's a disappointment both creatively and commercially. I mean, it tripled its budget. You know, Spielberg has not made a ton of movies in the last 20 years, but it's a new level where, you know, we're looking at $800 million, $1 billion. This movie tripled its budget, got over $525 million, but with poor reviews and not a lot of excitement around it, I feel like it's sort of a missed opportunity. Not a missed opportunity because it's a bad book, but I don't feel like it's a really exciting entry in the Spielberg canon.
Let's put it this way. We'll talk about this later, but I had to see the first 30 minutes of it recently for an LED screen, you know, kind of looking at an LED screen. And I had to walk out of the screening because I had another appointment, but I did not mind leaving. And if a movie is good, I'm like, oh man, I can't believe I got to leave. But I was like, okay, I've seen enough. Got to go.
Well, we're recording our show on Monday, and Tuesday morning, the Tony nominations will be announced. Maybe Amy Schumer will be one of them. She appeared on Broadway, and she has a new movie out. It's called I Feel Pretty, $9 million on the weekend, $35 million so far. It's in five territories. Not doing great. A good concept, but I don't think they quite delivered. And number eight is another horror flick. It's Blumhouse's Truth or Dare, $6 million on the weekend, and just under $50 million worldwide. And number nine is Peter Rabbit. That's at $320 million. And number 10 is Black Panther, $1,333 million. That's so much money. And the Avengers grossed half of that on its opening weekend.
And in North America, every other film dropped like 50% or more. You know, you had Rampage dropping 50%. You had A Quiet Place dropping 50%. And you had Black Panther dropping 11%. Wait, what? In its 11th week, it dropped 11%. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it moved up the charts. I thought it actually made more money this weekend than last because there was sort of renewed interest in it, but I guess that's not the case.
Oh, I don't know.
Yes.
I guess it wouldn't have because then it wouldn't be down 11%.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought it had gone up this weekend, but there you go. So if you wanted to be in the top 10 worldwide, you had to gross more than $5 million. That's what Black Panther did. If you wanted to be on the chart at all, which came from ComScore, you had to gross at least $1.4 million. So again, we just gave you our info. If you know a movie that grossed more than $1.4 million anywhere in the world combined, and we don't have it on our list, let us know so we can check out that movie and make sure we try and include it down the road. At number 11, grossing $4.5 million, is Blockers, the funny comedy. I liked it. $75 million and counting. The French action comedy Taxi 5, that hit $25 million. Super Troopers 2, that's at number 13. It opened in North America last weekend. It's in just the United States, just North America. It grossed $3.6 million this weekend. It's at $22 million and counting. I've seen figures that said it was crowdfunded to the price tag of $4.5 million. But apparently, that's not the total budget for the film. They ended up at $13 million, which seems like a lot given how little the first movie grossed. But they've doubled it. They're just about to double it. It's falling hard and falling fast, but they'll probably... And that movie certainly had a long life on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming, and they certainly hope the same for Super Troopers 2. But has to be one of the most successful movies ever crowdfunded, that's for sure.
Yes.
And number four is Genghis Khan, an epic romance drama. I think this is Chinese as well.
Number 14.
I'm sorry. $3.3 million that made. Here's another new film, The Trough. It's a Hong Kong crime thriller. It was co-written, directed, and starring Nick Cheung. So good news on him, $2.9 million on his opening weekend. Isle of Dogs is sort of slowing down. I guess it has a lot of territories to go, but it's at $45 million worldwide. That religious biopic that we talked about, that seems to be half the ticket sales, if not more, seem to come from the church itself. That's at $30 million, mostly in Brazil, I assume. Here's another new film, Guernsey. That's the short title for a movie that's actually fully called The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society. And frankly, that's the title they should use because it's a lot more memorable than Guernsey. It's based on a best-selling novel, and it's about a writer who bonds with the people of Guernsey while writing about their experiences during the war. It stars Lily James from Downton Abbey and Matthew Good. It was directed by Mike Newell, but unfortunately it got poor reviews. It opened up last weekend, and it's now at $6.8 million. But I don't know the budget. I assume it's fairly modestly budgeted, but who knows? The Met Opera had a live performance that appeared on screens in eight territories. It's their production of Cendrillon. It's a spin on Cinderella, and it stars the singer Joyce DiDonato. I'm going to see it Thursday night with our friend Stephen Garrett. I'm very excited about that. One of the last things he does before he heads off to Cannes with you.
That's right.
And it grossed $2.3 million around the world. Speaking of Cannes, one film that people were surprised wasn't opening up there was Loro. That's an Italian drama by director Paolo Sorrentino, who's a favorite of Cannes. And it's a biopic about Silvio Berlusconi. It opened up in Italy. I think it's part one. I think it's a two-part film somehow. But it grossed $2.1 million. I haven't read the reviews yet, but I'm excited to hear what it's all about.
Well, I think actually is trying to get away from the, well, I know you opened in your home territory, but you can still, you know, premiere here in France. I think they're saying, look, this is a festival for premieres. Premiere it here or go home.
No, absolutely. They said specifically that's what we're doing. And so this film is only part one open in Italy. People thought they would hold off and debut at Cannes and then open in Italy. But nope, they wanted to go a few weeks before Cannes, and so they lost that slot. And number 22 is The Coach. It's a Russian drama about a football superstar who flubs a penalty kick and then flees to a small town and decides to coach the local team. I'm sure it's heartwarming. It opened up last weekend, and it's now at $7.4 million.
I'd say that this seems ripe for a remake, if it's any good, right? An American remake. Except then, you know, you'd have to actually, you know, soccer would have to be a popular sport here. Which it is.
And it is.
It is, and it's becoming more popular. But, yeah, I don't know if it can hold a movie. Maybe it can.
Bend It Like Beckham, anyone?
Okay, yes, but that was more popular overseas.
That was a big hit here in the U.S.
Yeah.
That did quite well.
Okay.
Going all the way down the chart to one more new movie is Javier Bardem starring in Loving Pablo, a film about the hated drug lord, Pablo Escobar. That also opened up last weekend. It's at $6.7 million worldwide. And coming up, not just my birthday, but May 1st is another big holiday in China. May Day is sort of their equivalent to Labor Day, of course. And it's a big festival and a big weekend. So we should have good box office all week long and maybe into next weekend. One movie also opened up in China last week. It's already off the charts, but it's worth mentioning. It's called Looking for Romare. It was released in China. It was the first wide-release film that explicitly deals with gay issues. But it's not that explicit, and I mean that in every sense of the word. It got mixed reviews and poor box office because the gay angle of the film was so subtle and implied, it barely registered as gay at all. All the gay people who saw it were like, really? Like, you know, somebody glances at someone like, ah, that's it. So they felt like it was too timid to actually capitalize on the fact that it was the first, you know, technically gay film to get a wide release. But it does follow on top of the scandal involving Weibo, which said they weren't going to ban gay content from their platform and got a lot of outcry. And then on the bad spin, you got Kenya. They banned a gay film that is going to be playing at Cannes called Rafiki. It's going to world premiere at Cannes. And now Kenya says we won't show it in our country because it shows gay people in too positive a light.
Well, you know, speaking of Chinese content, okay, and you were just talking about the Chinese film here. One thing I learned at this year's CinemaCon, and it came from a couple of high-level executives and industry executives, is that Hollywood is screwed. And as you can kind of see from this week's top 25, there are a number of Chinese films in that top 25, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a big holiday weekend too, to be fair.
And are American films or Hollywood films opening right now?
No, but that's getting fewer and fewer, isn't it?
Yeah. But basically, the gist of the conversations I was having were, once China figures out how to make a movie, and right now the movies are, according to the executives I'm talking to, not very good, okay, but people will still go see them. Once they figure out how to make good movies, they're not going to need Hollywood anymore. They'll just play, you know, Chinese content.
I think that's nonsense.
Now, they're not going to not play Hollywood films, okay, but there will be, it will be predominantly Chinese content. But right now, the films are very poor, according to the people I was
Well, they can block movies and just not show them and let it suffer, but I don't know if the theater owners will want to stand for that. You know, I think the issue is, you know, obviously access to markets, you know, Hollywood wants that. China can block it right now. That should be illegal under World Trade Organization rules, and they should be suing them. We've seen Hollywood movies become more and more and more popular in China, not less and less. The more Hollywood movies they see, the more they want to see. I think both can flourish side by side as they do in a lot of other parts of the world. Maybe there'll be more mano a mano on, like, say, French films and Spanish films where, you know, they play second fiddle to most Hollywood movies, right? Not in terms of quality, but in terms of blockbusters. China is making big blockbuster movies. They're not traveling outside of Asia too much. You know, is Us and Them going to make big bucks in the U.S. and much of the world? Probably not. Will they care? I think they will. You know, they're going to want to make more money all over the world. Why not? When the bigger the budget gets, the more you need to make money everywhere, not just your home territory. You know, Avengers would not be a big success story necessarily if it just played in the U.S. So I think they're going to learn from Hollywood. They're certainly not going to make it easy for Hollywood. But I think the quality of the films is such that, you know, they're not going to be able to keep it out eventually. I think Hollywood's had more and more success, so I don't see why we should be, you know, they're saying the movies are going to be some so good, they just won't need Hollywood. But, you know, that's how they feel at CinemaCon, and there's a lot of fun stuff to learn at CinemaCon. You get to see clips from a lot of different movies. There were no full screenings done this year, but perhaps the most telling moment was not the clips themselves, but the actual atmosphere around the presentation from 20th Century Fox. They, of course, may be snapped up by Disney. They may be merging with them. And that affected everything about what was going on with them. Some of the press reports said, look at all these great films we're going to miss out on if Disney snaps them up and doesn't keep making them. What was your impression sitting in the room?
Wow. Talk about emotional. It started off hilarious. Chris Aronson is the head of domestic distribution. Every year he opens up the presentation from Fox with a big song and dance number of some kind. And he comes out, you know, dancing. He's not a good dancer, but, you know, he's not a performer. But it's always funny. It's always hilarious. And, you know, the head of NATO has told other studios, look, you got to up your game. You know, you've got to do something to keep people interested. And Fox is really knocking it out of the park every single time. This year, they opened up with a video with Deadpool. They did a chorus line number and they introduced Chris Aronson and he's nowhere to be found. And then all of a sudden on the screen, there is Deadpool. Okay. In bed, talking to us in the audience, 3,000 people in the audience in the Coliseum in Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas. And he's talking to us and you kind of see a foot and eventually you realize, oh my God, that's Chris Aronson's foot. And he wakes up Chris Aronson and he's like, come on, you got to get downstairs. He's seeing Chris, oh my God, I'm late. And then you realize that they were having a drunken night out and Chris Aronson is late and he stumbles in from the back of the auditorium. But there were allusions to Disney because on screen, after Chris Aronson runs off and Hugh Jackman was involved in the whole stunt as well, Goofy gets up from underneath the bed, rubbing his head as if he's got a hangover and kind of stumbles off screen, which was, you know, kind of an allusion to, you know, what's going on.
Not an allusion, it's a direct reference.
It's a direct reference. And then Stacey Snyder comes out and she is the head of the studio right now and basically shows a clip reel from the last 85 years of 20th Century Fox movies and all of their big hits. And it was probably one of the most emotional and melancholy, you know, show reels and presentations of any studio that I've ever seen at a Show West or CinemaCon. Because the reality is, this probably is the last presentation by 20th Century Fox. they probably will not be there next year. They will be a part of Disney. And Disney, the way they pretty much show up is, we're Disney, we make blockbusters, you have to play them. Here's a few clips, maybe. We don't have to put on a song and dance because you're going to play those films anyway.
But I mean, do you not think Disney is buying Fox so they can just shut it down and pretend it never existed?
No.
Don't they want to buy it so they can continue to make those movies, which are in addition to the types of movies Disney makes, like Fox Searchlight and so on?
I would hope so. I would absolutely hope so. Mm-hmm. But then, think about it this way: do they? Well, I know they don't own Miramax anymore, but you know when they did own Miramax. Did they keep making Miramax movies?
Yes, absolutely. They did a great job with that. Absolutely. It brought a whole new level of an Oscar-winning potential that Disney didn't have before. It was a very distinctive, important part of Disney. It was a great pick. Yeah, I feel like they totally supported Miramax for years.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would say Chris Aronson, probably a lot of fun, but he's only fun because you know him. It's like watching your kid in the school play. I don't think the rest of America would get a kick out of seeing him on stage dance poorly.
No. I mean, you'd have to understand that he's an executive at a movie studio, and yeah.
Yeah, even understanding it's still, you know, if you know him, it's funny, but I don't think it would really kill in the heartland.
No. And actually, the way they ended that presentation was they had a marching band come in. And now, mind you, Chris Aronson is...
getting all Beyonce on us.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, exactly. Had a marching band come in from the back of the auditorium and line up around the stage and down the aisles and play the 20th Century Fox theme, you know, that kind of like intro that you hear in front of Star Wars. And it was definitely
written by Lionel Newman. Yeah,
it was definitely one of those, because you knew that's it, they're out.
Well, at least it wasn't a brass band from New Orleans playing a funeral march.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, it could have been, but you were there, and it's, you know, Fox may be saying goodbye and LED screens may be saying hello. That seemed to be the big technological story of the festival of CinemaCon, that they, an LED screen has opened up in downtown LA, in a suburb, I should say, not a downtown. There's the first commercial LED screen is up in the U.S. They're showing Spielberg's Ready Player One. There are already screens up in South Korea, Shanghai, Bangkok, and Zurich. They expect to have 10 LED screens open by the summer and 30 by the end of 2018 worldwide. That's 30 out of tens of thousands, of course.
140,000, something like that? Yeah.
140,000 screens worldwide. So let's keep that in perspective. But some people want to tell us, Samsung and Sony, they believe LED screens are the future for theater exhibition. What was it like and what do you think?
Well, remember, we talked about this last year when Sony showed their Crystal LED, which they're still showing, and it looks really impressive. It is absolutely beautiful. The picture is stunning, and you know, with hands down, brighter and crisper, and the high dynamic range, the colors, the contrast. I mean, I could go on and on. Samsung a little less so, but then some of the content I was seeing was not timed necessarily for that particular screen. I was at the opening of that theater in Winnetka that you referred to. And it's a huge screen. It's like, you know, 35 feet wide. And you know, it definitely, there are some advantages to an LED screen. There are some
cheaper to operate.
Cheaper to operate. They last longer. They are far, far, far brighter. I mean, you know.
And just to explain what that means, when I go to movies every once in a while, I'm not sure if I'm seeing the movie properly, because a lot of theaters will, you know, small change us on the bulbs. They turn the bulbs down because they have, when they replace the bulbs in the digital projector, it can cost like, what, $6,000,
$8,000? No, $1,000. Like between $800 to $1,200, mostly in the $1,000 range.
So they hate to replace them, even though in the scheme of things, that should not be something that they're chintzing on, because that means the image on screen is darker and it's harder to see. I saw Black Panther, believe me, that night scene, it was a murky mess. I had no idea what was going on. And I bet a lot of that had to do with the bulb.
It absolutely did. It also has to do with the screen. So if you're seeing it in a theater that shows real D 3D and you're not watching it in 3D, more than likely you're seeing it on a silver screen, which kind of lends a gray tint to all of the images. Cinematographers hate silver screens.
So what percentage of screens in America, it's an impossible question, are silver screens?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to. That's a good question. I have no idea.
But you would be at least 20%, or is that crazy
probably
high?
No, that's probably very true. At least 20%.
So, and those are the 3D screens. And if a movie's not being shown in 3D, which after opening weekend, a lot of them aren't.
Right.
Because there's just not as much demand anymore. So you're watching on the wrong screen with a bulb that is not at its correct brightness, which means you're getting a much poorer image.
Correct. And
that's happening all over the country.
Right. And the image is supposed to be standardized to 14 foot Lamberts. An LED screen, is the brightness equivalent of 88 foot Lamberts. Okay. It's a way of measuring
light. Six times as bright, more than six times as bright as the typical movie screen that you see today. And that doesn't, brighter is better. It is, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, without a doubt, you look at it and you go, wow, that is impressive.
So it sounds exciting, except there's a couple problems. One is the sound.
The sound, okay. Remember sound now, which is a compromise, okay? Without a doubt, it's a compromise. They place the speakers behind the screen, okay? And the screen is what's called microperf or perforated, so it's got little dots in it. And that allows—
I thought there were speakers all over the theater. I didn't think it was just behind the screen.
Well, it's not just behind the screen, but the center channels, you know, left, center, right, are behind the mm-hmm. screen. And okay. that makes it sound as if the characters on screen are speaking to you, okay? Or not to you, but speaking, you know, from the source. And the speakers around the room are surrounds, okay? Sometimes they're on the ceiling, and if you have 7.1, there's, you know, a left rear surround and a right rear surround, you know, so it depends on the theater
setup. Why can't they just be to the side of the screen? Left and right side, you know, like most home stereo speakers, you know, you have them there and there, and you sit in the middle.
Yeah, it doesn't, you can definitely tell. And okay. and in this case, in the case of the Samsung, they put the speakers on top of the screen. So they're above the screen, and you can tell there's some elevation there. It sounds like it's coming a little too high. The human brain can differentiate between left and right far easier than it can differentiate between, you know, up and down. So that's why they put it up, and it almost works, not entirely.
So the sound still needs fixing, and there's no way to put it behind the screen.
Not right now, no.
Or embed it in the screen, or just like, well, I don't know, yeah. So the sound's not working. It's a lot more expensive to install, and a lot of theaters just spent a lot of money putting in a laser projection system or a digital projection system. So like, huh, we got to get rid of our screens and start all over again? What the hell?
Yeah, and I think what you're going to see is a land rush. So you have these 30 screens. They'll all be Samsung. I think Samsung is probably subsidizing them a little bit to show the, you know, proof of concept.
Because
nobody
would want to pay $500,000 or $800,000 to put in an LED screen today.
Especially because the content itself is not being mastered and color timed for those screens. So you're basically getting a piece of content that is a DCP that is mastered for 14 foot Lamberts and then showing it at 88 foot Lamberts. It's not
ideal.
So
what did Ready Player One look like?
It looked like you kind of went, well, where are all the deep blacks that you expected? Well, they're in the print that is timed for 88 foot Lamberts, not the print that is timed for 14 foot Lamberts. And unfortunately, the studios are not going to master in color time, a print just for 30 screens.
So if a theater exhibitor is refusing to spend $1,000 on bulbs just to present an image correctly, how the heck are you going to convince them to triple their budget on buying an LED screen? If they're going to be penny pinching here, I can't imagine them forking out the money there to correct the problem they themselves have created.
Yeah, well, good point. First off, the price has to come down, which digital cinema did. The sound has to get fixed, and the issue of content has to be resolved. Well, the content mastering has to be resolved.
Right, and content remastering is a problem right now, isn't it? Studios have to prepare multiple versions of their films: digital 2D, digital 3D, digital 3D at multiple light levels, IMAX, maybe Dolby Cinema. They need local languages. I mean, it's already a mess. You think, oh, they just got to make a digital print, but in fact, they have to make multiple versions for every film.
Yeah, and it used to be that the promise of digital cinema was, oh, one deliverable. We'll only have one deliverable. Well, yes, that was the goal, and I think the studios and distributors have long since given up on one deliverable because every single film has 100 plus versions that are going out around the world.
And LED is not going to solve that.
No, absolutely not, because they're just one more deliverable.
So what happens on an LED screen if you switch from 2D to 3D?
Well, I didn't see the 3D demo because I was running around and was too
I don't
busy.
Mean what you saw visually. I mean, we have special screens for 3D. The silver screen is better for 3D than 2D. Does LED work just as well for 3D as 2D? Are the specs just the same? Is it going to be better?
Well,
it
would inevitably be better in that it would be brighter, number one. And number two, it would, at least for now, be with active glasses, meaning that what you're seeing is the glasses turn on and off, very quickly to provide the 3D, as opposed to passive, in which, you're basically sending everything through a polarizing filter. And that's just a brighter experience.
Are people talking about 3D still, or is it just whatever?
People are talking about it. They say, look, it's obviously fallen off. It's down to the 30% we all thought it would be.
Don't say we all thought it would be. They thought every movie would be 3D, and that's all we would ever want to see ever. So don't give them the credit of saying, oh, we knew it would come back down.
Well, Jeffrey Katzenberg thought it would be.
They thought it would be most movies most of the time. James Cameron did. They thought dramas would be in 3D. They thought it was just immersive and better. Everything was going to be 3D all the time, and they were wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think 3D always had its proponents, like the James Camerons and Jeffrey Katzenbergs of the world. Then I think there were people like you and I who were like, yeah, for Avatar, sure. For The Queen, as Jeffrey Katzenberg suggested, no, it's not going to be in 3D.
But you see the Cave of Forgotten Dreams. You think, why not The Queen to be in the middle of Buckingham Palace could be exciting. Cave of Forgotten Dreams, you're in a cave underground. In looking at cave paintings from hundreds of thousands of years ago, and it was magnetic. So 3D can be used well in any context. It's just not a format that you're going to want most of the time.
Yes, I would agree with you. In emerging territories, it is definitely working better. So China, for instance, is doing quite well.
It's just earlier on the arc, that's all. But correct. It's new and exciting. They'll get bored with it soon enough.
Now, speaking of emerging territories, big talk at this year's show was Saudi Arabia. And how it's opening up and how the first screen opened. It was a concert hall that was kind of refitted to become a movie theater. And just all of the hurdles in getting that done. And
they have a full production studio that opened up, a full production facility that opened up in Saudi Arabia. We've had some, I think, in other territories in the Middle East, but I think that's the first one in Saudi Arabia.
Yes. And they showed Black Panther. And everybody was afraid, oh, the censors are going to cut everything. They cut 40 seconds. And, they only cut 40 seconds. They said, oh, my goodness, how are we going to do this? Men and women, the men and the women are going to have to change sides. And normally in a concert, what they were doing with concerts now that women can attend, or now that they're actually having them, the women were on one side and the men on the other. Women and family. And however, in movie theaters, they didn't know how they were going to do that, because what if it's an animated film? There might be more women,
kids.
Yeah. And so they just said, yeah, you just intermingle. So it's, there were pictures of women sitting next to men at the opening. And of course, every manufacturer wants in, every exhibitor wants in, but Saudi Arabia,
there's money to be made.
Yeah. Saudi Arabia will be licensing, maybe 5 to 10 different exhibitors to go in there. And right now it looks like more along the lines of 5.
And so what about MoviePass? Was that talked about at CinemaCon?
Not as much as I would have thought. I thought this was going to be the MoviePass fest. I thought there was just nobody would just shut up about MoviePass. But yes, it was discussed. But even in the State of the Industry speech, it wasn't brought up directly. It was kind of referred to as a disruptor. And subscription services were referred to en masse. And then afterwards at the press conference, John Fithian, the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, and Charles Rifkin, the head of the Motion Picture Association of America, I was going to try and ask the first question, which would have simply been MoviePass, 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 pick any topic and talk about it. in other words, there's no question there. You can just, feel free to expound. And instead, Ann Thompson actually asked the first question, and she asked what was wrong with disruptors, which was a roundabout way of asking what's wrong with MoviePass. And needless to say, neither of them bit. And so 39 minutes in, somebody finally asked a question about MoviePass. And you know what? I met with MoviePass at the show. They explained why they... I asked your question, Michael. Why do you only have one way to sign up? Why don't you have the original way, which is, you know...
Well, we know why they don't have that. It's costing them too much money.
Well, it was also explained to me that when they did the iHeartRadio deal... part of the deal was that they would kind of funnel everybody through that program for 3 months. And then, you know, after the program was over, after the promotion was over, they could go back to...
Do whatever they want next.
Right. Well, then, yeah. And they're also, they said, additionally, we're also testing various schemes. So one way to do that is to, for a time, have a limited way to subscribe.
Yeah, yeah. Did they explain why the heck, what problem they're solving by having people take a picture of their ticket? Again, MoviePass has so much news, they need their own podcast. They keep adding new rules every day. We have the new program that they offer. We've already talked about it. Now they've added the new rule right before the Avengers opened up. They said you can't see any movie twice. If you've seen it once, right. You're done.
Right.
You can't
see Avengers
every day for a week.
Was a rule with MoviePass before it was purchased by HMNY. So
they dropped that rule. Now they've added it back in again. I don't really care about that. That's fine. They added a new security measure, which is totally bizarre. When you get your ticket, you then have to upload an image of that ticket stub to MoviePass. If you forget once, you can say, I forgot. If you forget twice, done. You're out. Go away. You never do MoviePass again. Why? What is the point of that other than inconvenience?
Well, right now what they're doing is... They are realizing that, yes, there is some fraud, but even if 1% of 2 million people are using it fraudulently, that's a lot of people using it fraudulently. Okay,
well, who's doing it fraudulently? I have yet to find any example of a person that they actually found who was doing it fraud. That's what they say for everything. It's, oh, we're fighting fraud. Like what?
So here's what they found. You know, a lot of people thought, oh, well, it's people buying tickets and then going in to go to the bathroom. You know, like, oh, gee, I have to go to the bathroom. It's for customers only. Oh, well, I've got this MoviePass. I'll buy a ticket to, I don't know, On Golden Pond and run into the bathroom here and then, you
what?
Know.
That's ridiculous.
Well, right. And I think
somebody's moving into a movie theater so they can use the bathroom.
So
no,
absurd. What they found, especially when you could see, you know, the same movie multiple times, was people would stand, especially at colleges. Okay. This is a big college thing. They would stand outside of the movie theater, purchase a ticket, and then, you know, sell it to somebody coming up to the box office. And keep the money. So now they're doing it with. So they did away with the multiple showings. That was something they probably never should have got. You know, done away with in the first place.
Yeah, that's an easy. That's a fine one. I don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
And now what they're trying to do is to prevent mostly younger the younger.
But I mean, how does taking a picture of the ticket stub change that?
Yeah, I tried to ask the question and you know it was deflected, which is you know. If I'm a college student, I go, I purchase the ticket, I take a picture of the ticket, right?
Then I sell it.
And then I sell it. Right, exactly.
Yeah, not that that's happening much, I imagine. That's, you know.
Right, but they're just, and what they said is they're testing certain things out. So, for instance, they don't do it to everybody, but whenever they test something.
Well, these are rules for everybody.
No, not for me. I didn't get that email.
You didn't get no repeat viewing?
No. The no repeat viewing is for everybody. Okay.
Oh yeah. Everybody I know but one got the you know, I know five people in New York who got the ticket stub thing. So it's not that much of a beta test. It's everybody, a lot of people.
I did not get it.
Okay.
And
I know one other person who didn't get it, but there you go.
But that said, you know, I've used it maybe three times. So I'm their ideal customer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've used it three times. We're in April.
Why don't you cancel it?
Well, because there's no reason to. I've already paid it for a year in advance and you know, I will by the end of the year.
Why don't you go to the movies?
Find the time.
Well, why'd you buy it?
Well, I thought I'd use it more often than
I did. Well, I'll tell you, I went to see Annihilation 2 weekends ago on a Saturday night. It was the only screen it was playing at in New York City, if not the entire country. It wasn't even on the charts when I looked, and there are movies on the charts with just one screen making like $800. I went on a Saturday night. It's the end of the run for a movie. It's been out for, you know, like 2 months. Got mixed reviews, decent, okay, not great box office. Went on a Saturday night at 7. Cinema Village, 12th Street. So in New York City, near college students, I guess, in a way. Jammed full. Sat in the second to last row, could barely get two seats together. jammed full for a movie like that. And it, when I was at the box office, everybody was using MoviePass. They had signs about MoviePass, how to do MoviePass. When somebody's MoviePass didn't work, they weren't checked in properly. The person could help them, tell them this is what you got to do. Somebody else, oh, they fixed that for them. I mean, clearly movie. And I asked them afterwards, I said, what percentage of the crowd there was MoviePass? She estimated only half. I was surprised it was even that low. She said, at this screening, I would say about half of them were. There were 98 paying customers. I'd say 48 or 53 used MoviePass. And she said on an opening weekend with a big movie, a majority of the people, well into the majority, would be using MoviePass in New York City.
Well, you know, certainly Mitch Lowe, the CEO of MoviePass, has said, you know, we're not too concerned about opening weekend because you can't buy in advance. Most of our subscribers will go the second or third weekend. That is true, certainly for me. But then I'm an older, you know, I'm not a college student.
I saw Star Wars and Black Panther opening weekend, no problem.
Okay.
You know, you just got to, you know, just like to go to see the movie, you got to, if you want to go at a certain time with your friends, you can't wait till the showtime. You got to go get it in advance anyway. Either you go to the box office like me because you're a cheap bastard and you have no money and you get it without avoiding the $2 surcharge, or you just go a couple hours early. And at this stage, you know, you swing by, get the ticket, and then 2 hours later, you go to the movie. But there's so many screens now, it's not that hard to get to opening weekend. But they did a survey. A Hollywood Reporter paid for a survey of MoviePass users. 83% are happier than with any other paid subscription they have. They are happier buying MoviePass than Netflix or Spotify or you name it. Amazon Prime, MoviePass is their favorite paid subscription service. They're seeing more movies and more types of movies. They're more likely to go on opening weekend, they say. Nearly half of them go alone sometimes. That's a lot higher than usual. 42% go midweek. And they're willing to pay more money for MoviePass. They'd pay $15 a month. They think it's worth it. They're recommending more movies to friends. And this survey says they're spending as much on concessions as full-price customers, and not cheaper customers. And in fact, they might pay more because they're going to movies and they didn't pay a ticket. They're like, oh, I'll get popcorn.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And a lot of times, they would not have seen films without MoviePass like All the Money in the World, A Bad Mom's Christmas, Daddy's Home 2, Phantom Thread, Molly's Game, and Hostels. Those were some of the movies they mentioned that they went to see they simply would not have seen otherwise. And 60% of them think it's too good to be true. 37% of them think it's definitely too good to be true, and it's not going to last.
Yeah, know? I mean, my only advice for MoviePass is, hey, stick to it. You know, stick to something, because you keep changing this stuff and it's really hard to keep up. So
they're losing too much money. I would say my message is not to MoviePass, because they have a business plan that doesn't make sense. They're hoping to flip it and make their money back, and it's worked before. It may work for them. But I think there's two lessons. One is that ticket prices are too high. That's why New York, LA, and Chicago, that's why those are the big cities where MoviePass has flourished. People are like, you know what, $15 is just too damn much money. You know, I understand they're in an urban center, rental prices and the rent that they pay on their space is huge. You know, that's why no business can last more than 5 years. They keep getting shoved aside because rents keep going up. Nonetheless, you know, $9 average ticket price, $15 really makes you think twice before you go see a movie. And MoviePass has shown them, wow, people are hungry to see movies cheaper. And clearly there's a core group of people who would love the chance to go to movies. And it could be a really positive thing. They're the early tastemakers. They're the people who can spread the word about films. They'll go see more movies. I think it's an audience worth cultivating. You're not going to be cannibalizing yourself too much. You'll be getting those people out to see movies and talking about it and spreading the gospel of going to the cinema. And I think it's something they really got to think about. I think there's clearly a demand both for lower ticket prices and or that monthly pass. That's how people consume their music. That's how they consume a lot of movies and TV shows at home. It may be a way they want to consume movies at the theater.
Yeah, and you know, I guess $15 a month is what some said they were willing to pay, and I think that's probably accurate. I think that $15 a month, it makes it just enough, you know, pain there to make you want to use it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And then you're in a big city, it's one ticket. If you think you'll go once a month, that's more than most people go to. The problem is it won't work unless it's a deal made between exhibitors and theater owners and whoever's handling the business. You can't do it on your own or you're going to lose your shirt.
Yeah, and one of the things that the folks from MoviePass pointed out when I was speaking with them is, you know, there's so much misinformation about what they're trying to do. And frankly, all they're trying to do is the same thing that Costco does when they go and buy bulk sales to Regal or AMC. You know, they get a special deal for, and then they sell it at their stores or group tickets. You know, they're looking for the same deal. Like, as
no, that's not what they're doing. Because they're looking for that same deal, but right now, oh my gosh, there you go. That's not what they're doing, because they're not getting a bulk discount. They're paying full price.
Correct. Correct.
Costco is not selling something at a loss every time.
No. They're not selling it at a loss. So
did they seem nervous and angry, upset, confused?
No,
or like, haha.
No. What they're saying is, you know, people think that we're trying to get a cut of the box office, and indeed, what we're trying to do is get the group rate.
Well, that's a different way of spinning it, but it hasn't happened yet.
Correct.
All right. Well, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of spin-offs and sequels and reboots happening at CinemaCon that you saw news about. And we've got some news there as well, don't we?
That's right. Fast and Furious, the animated series, will be on Netflix.
That's right. You know, I'm kind of excited by this.
What?
I am. You know why? Because I think animation has always been, you know, boxed into just the family-friendly thing. There are obviously plenty of examples we can name.
Speed Racer, come on.
Yeah, they're on TV, but movies especially, 90% of them, 95% of them have been just family-friendly fare. Some of it's very innovative, some of it's great, but it's often just family-friendly fare, and a particular type of family-friendly fare. And I think, obviously, Ralph Bakshi, there are other examples, The Lord of the Rings in the 70s. But I love to see animation being used in lots of different ways, and a Fast and Furious TV series is clearly not typical. And we've got the Spider-Man movie coming out in December. I think that's a great extension of it. So I'm excited to see animation being used in different genres in different ways than we've typically seen. Again, you got manga and anime, and films and TV properties from Japan and all over the world. It's just more example of that happening here, and I'm glad to see it.
You know what some people would say is, wait, you mean Fast and Furious wasn't animated? And now, speaking of animation, DreamWorks Animation, they're going to make a sequel to Turbo? Is that what I'm
No. Hearing? I was thinking because, you know, we had Turbo Fast, the TV show that we joked a lot about, because the Turbo, the movie, we were talking about whether it's profitable.
Okay.
And like, here's Fast and Furious now with the Speedy Snail. He's totally been upstaged by Vin Diesel.
Okay. Well, I don't even know where to go with that.
You should go to the bookstore.
Okay. Well, if I did go to the bookstore, let me ask you this. What should I read? Because in our book filter section every week, you give us a book that not only we should be reading, okay, which we can always find on bookfilter.com, but maybe a book that is ready for its close-up, a book that is ready to be adapted to a movie or a television series. What have you got for us this week?
Well, I've got two TV shows for you. One is Endling the Last by Catherine Applegate. It's a fantasy series geared towards middle grade kids. That's kids in like fourth to eighth grade. And she and her husband created a series of books called Animorphs, which was turned into a TV show on Nickelodeon for a couple seasons. This is the first book in a trilogy, at least a trilogy. It's called Endling the Last. And it's about a character, Bix, who is the last of her tribe. She's a particular type of creature, like a dog, but she walks on her hind legs and she has opposable thumbs and she can talk.
So what you're saying is this is definitely not an animated film, animated series.
No, it's got to be animated. Yeah. So you got me. And so Bix is the last of her tribe, and she pairs up with some friends to try to go on a quest to see if there are any other of her characters left surviving in the world. Now, Animorphs became this huge series. Tons of books. She and her husband launched it. Then they used ghostwriters. It became a TV series. And in that series, different key people were working together to fend off an alien invasion. Right? That's what happened in Animorphs. In this series, it's different creatures needing to fend off human beings, because the humans are trying to separate them one by one and eliminate each species piece by piece. So that's the sort of the setup of Endling the Last, but it's very cleverly written. It's for kids, but I think anybody who loves fantasy would enjoy it. It's clearly not going to be live action, but I found it just delightful, and I think it would make a good property. It's probably already been optioned. So I imagine has the memoir Adventures of a Young Naturalist by David Attenborough. Now, we all know David Attenborough. He's the voice of so many classic BBC and British documentary films about nature. And this memoir is about his time in 1954 when he was a young TV presenter and he was offered the chance to travel the globe tracking down rare and elusive animals for the London Zoo. It was sort of the beginning of his career and his lifelong link to nature documentaries. It's a charming book. It's probably already been optioned to make a great fictional series. I think it'd be a lot of fun to see a young David Attenborough pushing through the jungles, figuring it all out on the fly, discovering species. I think it would be a charmer.
Like a young Sherlock Holmes, but in this case, yeah, a young naturalist.
Yeah, young naturalist, that's right. But there is a lot of book news. According to a survey of 400-plus publishers, sales in the ebook format in the United States fell 10% last year. I talk a lot about the ebook format and how it's the dominant format for new books that are coming out. I mean, like bestsellers, fiction and nonfiction. I think that's still true. It's hard to get great info because that, of course, does not include self-published books released by Amazon. That's just from the publishers. But it is telling that the ebook format fell again last year. So that's an interesting little factoid. More interestingly and perhaps threateningly, the UK chain, the bookstore Waterstones, has been bought by a hedge fund. They were on the ropes. They were bought by a Russian billionaire. He turned the stores around, put in a new boss. Their profits went up 80% from 2011 to 2017 under the current head. And now it's been sold to a hedge fund. And they say they're committed to long-term growth, which if you're a hedge fund usually means they want to flip you in 5 years.
Correct.
Right. So the biggest bookstore chain in the UK has been purchased by a hedge fund. The biggest bookstore chain in North America, Barnes & Noble, also on the ropes. Waterstones has been doing a good job. Their profits have been up. Barnes & Noble is struggling, but both of them have futures that have to be sort of dire. And of course, one thing they'd love to have is that new Game of Thrones book by George Martin.
Oh, yeah, but I don't think they'll ever get that. I mean, certainly not this year, and certainly, I would be shocked if it ever was released.
Ever? What are you talking about?
Well, okay, fine. Ever is a long time. But certainly, if you told me that it wasn't going to be around until 2022, I'd say, okay, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Well, he does have a new book coming out this year. It's just not the one you want. It's a popular history of the past of his imaginary world. It's really a history. It's not a novel. He keeps emphasizing that. It's called Fire and Blood. It's due out November 20th. Fans said, oh my God, I'm excited. Or they said, why aren't you finishing the book?
Yeah, I don't know. He's too busy running an independent movie theater.
Well, he's you know, it's complicated. You know, the books get bigger and bigger and, let him take his time and do it right. You know, you don't want him to rush it, that's for sure. But we do know that the Nobel Committee is not rushing it. We've talked about the scandal at the Nobel Prize for Literature Committee. Another member has just stepped down. 7 people have resigned from the committee. It's a major crisis. They won't be able to make their quorum, it looks like. This year's prize may be canceled for the first time since World War II. And I have to say it's a shame because when you look at the people they have given the Nobel Prize for Literature in the last 10 or 15 years, they've had some really good, interesting, and bold choices. So it's a shame to see them in such crisis.
I think maybe the Nobel Committee is calling to add you to the board right now.
Oh, that would be exciting. That would be really cool. I would love that. I imagine the honorarium is more than I'm making at Showbiz Sandbox.
Hey!
No, yes, you're keeping all the profits for yourself. But of course, the Nobel Committee is in a crisis because of a sexual misconduct scandal, which leads us to
our sexual misconduct section, which we have been running ever since Harvey Weinstein in the, October of last year. It's kind of our hashtag Me Too segment.
That's right. Oh, that's a good one. You could call it that. But yeah, then it sounds like you're saying you sexually misconducted too.
Yeah, no, I have not. So I deny everything. That said, Bill Cosby denied everything and a jury of his peers did not believe him this time around. This was the retrial of Bill Cosby for, sexual assault.
I'm not sure what the actual legal definition was, but yes, he drugged and raped a woman and he was found guilty. This retrial was so dramatically different than the first trial, the number of people who testified, evidence that was allowed into the case. It's going to be appealed. And I think the analysis that it's likely he might well prevail. It's not a given, but it's kind of likely. So, this is not the end of the run. We'll have to see what happens eventually. But at least justice was found for a day.
Yes. And, part of the reason that he might prevail in this case is, well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to, I should preface this. The jury can play on emotions, which is understandable. Everybody's human.
The jury?
A jury trial. can play
Can
play off emotions, whereas an appellate ruling is usually not a jury trial. It's usually, it comes down to boiled, you know, hard-boiled law. So it'll be interesting to see whether he can, you know, who knows?
Well, another accuser of Bill Cosby is headed to the Supreme Court. In 2014, the New York Daily News printed a story in which Catherine McKee said Bill Cosby raped her in a hotel room in Detroit in 1974. In response, his lawyer sent a letter to the paper calling her a liar, false and defamatory. In response to that, she sued. And now they're headed to the Supreme Court because of a decision of whether she's a public figure. Her lawyers basically say, hey, because you speak out publicly and say, I was assaulted, that should not make you a public figure and thus raise the bar of what is defamatory. You know, if you're a public figure, it's harder to sue someone else for defaming you because you have less rights. You're a public figure. People can say mean and hateful things about you. You have less grounds to fight them off. And so her lawyer is saying, hey, why are you victimizing her twice? Just because she came forward to say I was raped by Bill Cosby doesn't mean suddenly she's a celebrity. His lawyers say quite a different thing. And that case is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, which is interesting. It's an interesting angle. It's an interesting issue to deal with. But the funny thing is her lawyer is Charles Harder, who also represented Hulk Hogan when he successfully sued Gawker and drove that company out of business. And he also represents President Trump in the Stormy Daniels case. So, wow. It gets very confusing.
Talk about clients.
Yeah, exactly. So Tom Brokaw might want to call him because he was accused of sexual misconduct. So was Stan Lee. In Tom Brokaw's case, we know that some 60 female journalists came forward and signed a letter saying he'd been a positive force in their careers and they'd always seen him behave like a gentleman and appropriately. That includes Rachel Maddow and other people. But let's not forget, women came forward with Al Franken and said he'd been great with them as well. Just because someone works well with you doesn't mean they're necessarily doing it well with others.
Yeah, and he actually, I mean, he was pissed. I don't know if you read his letter, but he was happy.
But not, some of it didn't help him either. You know, she's just out to, you know, some of it was, you know, not helpful. Maybe I shouldn't have gone to her hotel room. You know, she's just scheming to get ahead, you know, as opposed to all the people who don't want to go ahead in their career, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
I would not have allowed him to release that. If I would have counseled him not to.
Yeah, I would have said, look, you know, let's edit this.
Well, he sent it to friends, but you knew it would get out. But it's not easy. You know, your reputation, your decades ago, you feel like you want to fight it back. We'll see if other people come forward. If no one does, it doesn't mean this woman is not telling the truth. But that makes it easier for those of us on the outside to say, well, 50 people came forward. That's not so confusing anymore. But people come forward and they sometimes get slapped down. That's what's happening in the Indian film industry. They're trying to grapple with this of a sorts. The Telugu film actress Sri Reddy came forward. She's been protesting against the practice of the casting couch. Directors and other people in the industry demanding sexual favors from female actors. And a pretty drastic move. Remember, in Indian cinema, often characters won't kiss. She stripped naked outside the Telugu Film Chamber of Commerce on April 7th. That's how radical she is in the context of the Indian film industry. And now they're saying she has been penalized. The Telugu Film Industry's Movie Artists Association is threatening to act against anyone who employs her. They're like, you cannot employ her. And is she getting support from fellow women? Not always. The film choreographer Saraj Khan, who's Hindi, she said, this has been going on for ages. It's not new. She says, someone or the other always tries to take advantage of girls. Government officials also do this. Why are you only targeting the film industry? This industry provides livelihood, at least, does not rape and abandon you. End quote. Meaning, in other words, sure, we force you to commit sexual favors, but at least we give you a job afterwards. So
I don't think that's the way it works.
She's a major figure. She has choreographed some 2,000 songs. She is a major star, Saroj Khan. And so she's got a lot to learn. Let's put it that way.
Well, Sri Reddy is a big star, and we have some news stories.
She's a big deal in Indian cinema.
Okay. I know you were trying to throw to me for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the Star Trek universe has already seen a woman at the top. Kate Mulgrew was the captain of the Voyager for 7 seasons. But now a woman is really going to be in charge. The Star Trek IV feature film starring Chris Pine is set to have S.J. Clarkson as director. She's the first female director in franchise history and will oversee a story about Captain Kirk somehow time traveling and running into his own dad, who will be played by Chris Hemsworth. That kind of makes sense. I don't know about the time traveling thing, but they kind of look like each other. This is separate from the film, by the way, being worked on by Quentin Tarantino and J.J. Abrams. Big deal or big whoop?
Soon it will be a big whoop, maybe in 10 or 20 years, but right now it's still a big deal. But great news with the Taiwanese director, the female director, and her big box office hit. So this is another great example. Give them a chance at that, they're going to succeed.
Oops, if YouTube isn't getting in hot water for the content of the videos it airs, it's getting in trouble for the ads that run on them. CNN reports that blue chip advertisers were seeing their ads run on white supremacist channels as recently as a few weeks ago. Of course, it would be easy for YouTube to make certain no one's ads ran on unacceptable channels like that, but that would mean only opting in on videos and channels they actively approved of rather than just tossing in ads on everything and worrying about the consequences later, which is kind of what they do. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, they've known about this problem for a while now, and some of these ads ran in the last few weeks. You know, if you're trying to advertise and you want to reach people, why not advertise on a safe harbor like a podcast?
Yes, I've got one. Well, This American Life, although they don't accept ads, so you'll just have to give us your money.
There you go.
Now, you know, somebody, at CinemaCon, there was a debate about this, about the ads appearing next to white supremacist videos or these, you know, inflammatory videos. And somebody suggested on a panel, well, what does that say about you that you're noticing that? That means you went to those videos.
I went to the movies and I thought, my God, there's like 25 minutes of ads. I remember when the ads began and I would boo and people would boo to say, no, we will not see ads in movie theaters. No, no, no. And now it's like, yeah, whatever.
Director Steven Spielberg, he's feeling feisty. First, he directed two movies back to back, jumping onto The Post while Ready Player One was almost set to go. Now he's got Indiana Jones and then a remake of West Side Story lined up. Please don't do the latter. And before he's even started shooting, Spielberg is committing to join the DC comic book universe. The people behind DC could sure use Spielberg's star power, especially since he'll be tackling the little-known comic book Blackhawk. That's set during and after World War II, when a team of aviators fought the Nazis and other invaders. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for DC. They certainly need some star power. They need a big quality hit, and maybe Spielberg can give that to them. Blackhawk, by the way, is one of only four comic book characters to be published in their own series continuously from the 40s through the end of the 60s for three decades. And when you think of the other ones, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Black Hawk. You know, when you go, who's Black Hawk? This was a big, big comic book in its day. So I'm kind of excited to see what he does with it. And I have to say, I thought it was unusual that he had two films so close to back-to-back in release. And I went back to look. It's actually happened quite a lot in his career. So it's really not that unusual that he had The Post and Ready Player One. I mean, he had films open up like 8 days apart once, but like 6 months, 8 months, it's happened quite a few times since the early 80s. So not so unusual for Spielberg. He's a hardworking guy.
Yeah, and keep in mind, he was the one who kind of was directing Schindler's List, okay, and in between takes would...
Finishing Jurassic Park, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the one that came out, yeah.
Yeah, and at CinemaCon, they showed Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Uh-huh.
And this is the
Crickets.
No, it's the animated film. It's kind of hard to explain. It's like, you know, these are people that are trying to become superheroes. You know, they want to be they're like the sidekicks.
Superhero school. Yeah.
And so there was one line in one of the clips where the guy said, oh, that's so dark. Are you sure you're not a DC comic?
Yeah. I thought it played poorly, though.
Yeah, it didn't really play that well.
Yeah, that's what I meant by crickets.
Oh, okay. Now, the European Union is insisting that commercial spaces switch over to more energy-efficient lighting, and that has the theater community in the West End in an uproar. They are looking at switchover costs in the hundreds of millions of euros, a price some smaller venues simply couldn't afford. The more efficient and safer lights save money in the long run, but anyone who has shelled out $15 for a single halogen bulb knows the upfront costs can be steep. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, you're looking at 180 million euros that the West End theater industry may be facing under these lighting proposals. It will drive some smaller companies out of business. It's something that should happen, but there needs to be, as there often is in the UK, some government subsidy or some help or some grandfathering in so that people can say, all right, when these lighting systems, you know, fade out, then we can replace them rather than having to do everything all at once. Some help needs to be given to them or they're really going to be hurting.
Well, yeah. Now, you know, I just got that song stuck in my head, you know, the one that goes, wasted away again in Times Square. Wait, Times Square?
What?
Jimmy Buffett's new musical is struggling on Broadway, but that isn't stopping the Coral Reefer from believing tourists and Buffett are in an ideal match. He announced plans to open a Margaritaville Resort Hotel at 7th Avenue and 40th Street, a theme park of a space that will include 234 rooms, 29 stories, a rooftop bar, and the Buffett-branded eating and drinking establishments like the Margaritaville restaurant and the 5 o'clock somewhere bar.
Not to mention a lost shaker of salt.
Ooh. It's set to cost $300 million and will open in late 2020. It will close in 2022. No, just kidding. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, I don't know why you think it would close. Seems like, you know, Times Square is a theme park and it makes sense to me.
Yeah, okay.
It's just a nice, you know, nice hotel, but as long as it's done well, who cares?
Okay, well, it seems like, isn't it all beach-oriented? Beach-themed?
They'll have, yeah.
You know, there's one in Las Vegas as well, so go figure. Spotify has gone public, and the billions the company has earned from its stock options has the streaming service in a generous mood. A new version of the app makes Spotify even more appealing. In the past, people who didn't pay for the service could only listen to music on random shuffle. But now Spotify has struck a deal with record labels to allow on-demand listening to the 750-plus tracks that appear each week on hugely popular playlists like Discover Weekly, Daily Mix, and Today's Top Hits. Critics say it's one more reason people won't bother paying for the service. Spotify says it can now serve as a de facto R&D department for the labels. Watch what new songs people glom onto in real time. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, unless it just proves hugely effective in discovering new artists. I mean, they're just basically saying, let us have a radio station. You know, let us turn these really popular playlists onto more people so that casual fans can discover weekly and Daily Mix, Today's Top Hits, and react to the songs and go, oh, I love that artist. And is that helpful to the labels or is it putting the cart before the horse? You know, I don't know. But certainly if you're just a casual listener of Spotify, it makes it more appealing.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has been roiled by change, and it's not over yet. The latest scuffle involves William Mechanic, a.k.a. Bill Mechanic, he's a producer now, but he was a studio executive. He resigned from the board, but not before releasing a scathing statement about its many problems. Mechanic says the board is so big it's unwieldy. He also objects to presidents being elected for one-year terms with a maximum of 4. They can be re-elected, but the ability to long-range planning is severely curtailed. He says because of this, the CEO has way too much power. The museum is insanely over budget. Any employee who objects to anything is tossed out. Inclusion is the problem of the industry, not the academy. And sexual misconduct should be handled by the police, not the board. His final quote, "We have failed." Mic drop. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal and a big whoop. You know, he makes some valid points and some silly points. The inclusion in the film industry is the problem of the industry, but the inclusion at the academy is in fact the problem of the academy. Sexual misconduct should automatically be handled by the police. You pick up the phone and call the cops, but you also need to look into it yourself after the police have been alerted. You know, you think a crime's been committed, you call the cops. You don't decide to figure out whether a crime's been committed. Someone says, I was assaulted, or, you know, call the cops. Then you also need to do your own policing of yourself because there are things that don't rise to the level of criminality, but do rise to the level of that's not acceptable where we are. So, you know, but the size of the board, the fact that a president has just a one-year term, those are excellent points to be made.
Well, yeah, and I hear more and more griping about this throughout the industry, specifically about the chairman, or is it the CEO? I think it's the CEO, Don Hudson.
Right.
And, you know, they're just like, you know, certainly, I can't remember the name, Cheryl Boone Isaacs and Don Hudson were notoriously, you know, hated each other, and they would fight over who would get the cover of magazines. And, you know, certainly.
So does everybody at every corp, you know.
Yeah.
They're no different than any other top people. And her pushing out people who don't agree with her agenda is no different than any other top executive. I don't know whether she's doing a good job, but I think, employees that disagree with her are pushed out. Well, why would she keep them if they disagree with her? Why would she's in charge? But I will say, you know, his complaints, inclusion, who cares? He was replaced by another white male. So, you know, maybe he's right sometimes. Some other things, maybe he has a little learning to do.
Well,
but you learned Bette Midler's coming back to Broadway, and you already got your tickets, didn't you?
Yes, I did. In the mezzanine. Thank you for guiding me as to which seat I should get.
Well, I'm so excited. I mean, I never imagined such a birthday present, but really, I don't know how to thank you. It's such an amazing, unbelievable. I mean, so generous of you. I just can't believe. Hello? Hello?
Did I say I bought the tickets already? I meant I was thinking about buying. Yeah.
Time for Inside Baseball. It's time for
Okay. Well, it's time for Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're talking about the Writers Guild, which is getting serious about talent agents. These are the agencies that help employ writers and directors and actors and musicians. They want to cancel their current agency agreement. This is a franchise agreement. It ends in 12 months, and they are dead serious about this.
And I mean, they just see all these agencies, just like their managers, moving into production and having so many conflicts of interest that seem obvious and endless to them that they're saying, look, we got to establish some new rules or actually just start reinforcing the rules that made sense all along. So they were saying no more package deals, right?
Yes. And I know, Michael, we talked about this in the pre-show. You don't want to go into a long history of this, so I'm going to try and curtail this, which is, long story short, you had all of these agencies slowly get into television production, MCA being the most famous for it. MCA became Universal. And they were making content that their stars and talent was starring in, which is a conflict of interest. It attracted the attention of Robert Kennedy when he was the attorney general. And they had MCA, when they merged with Decca Records, had to make a decision, be a talent agency or be a production company.
But now suddenly people are doing it all over again.
It's like a big cycle. So for, 40 years, SAG kind of said, look, the franchise agreement means that you can't be a talent agent and be a, produce content. By the way, the one waiver for that the one waiver that MCA got to get into the television business, guess who it was offered by?
Who?
The president of SAG. And that was back in 1940. I can't remember exactly when. I think it was 1968 or something like that. 1958. I don't know, but it was the president of SAG at the time was Ronald Reagan. That was the punchline, right? There. Ronald Reagan gave it to him. And that was.
But haven't agencies been packaging like shows like The Cosby Show? That was famously packaged.
That's right. And in fact, the William Morris Agency probably would have gone under in the 1990s if they weren't receiving the packaging fees from all the.
But this has been going on for decades. It didn't start up recently.
Absolutely not. In fact, everybody always knew, the movie side, motion picture lit, as it was called, and motion picture talent. That was the kind of glamorous side of the business, but it certainly wasn't the side that made money. The television side is where you made money because of all these packaging. You basically bring directors and showrunners and writers to a network and say, here's your show, and then the network would pay for a long period of time the agency.
Right, and it creates endless conflicts of interest. I don't know why it's ever been allowed, because if you're packaging a TV show, then you get a cut of the show's profits, which means you don't want your star to be paid as much as you might otherwise, because that's money out of your pocket. Furthermore, when you're casting the show, you say, well, we want all our own actors on it. So instead of saying what's best for the show, you're saying what's best for CAA. And that means all these different actors, even if they're not best for the role, that means we want the star and the director and the creator to be paid less money because maybe we get more. It just creates endless conflicts.
Yeah. And, this whole you can't produce content and be the agent, that was kind of in place until about 2002. And the reason that agencies push back on SAG and the WGA with their franchise agreements was that they felt like, you know what, managers are out there, these talent managers, and they don't have the same constraints, okay? They're allowed to, you know, help find work for the client, which they're not supposed to be doing, by the way, and they're allowed to be a producer and take a producer's salary and role on some of these projects, which gives them more money.
So the WGA says the response is not to let you do it too, it's that we need to stop everybody from all these conflicts of interest. So they're going to start with the agencies, then they're going to turn to the managers.
Yeah, I have a feeling that once the agencies kind of have their wings clipped, the managers will as well.
And everybody is going to be supporting the WGA, and by everybody, I mean the directors, the actors, all the creative people are going to be siding with WGA and want to see this happen because they're the ones who are also facing the same conflicts from their agents and their managers. They're saying no more package deals, no cut of the pie on movies. You got to work for us, not the film, not the studio, no producing. You got to work for us, no double dipping. You can't take a commission so that we're making less than the minimum just because of your 10%. We got to always make at least the minimum, which is why a lot of deals and TV and stuff include minimum plus 10, because you want to make sure they don't dip below that. But that is happening now for some people. So this is a big deal. They got a year to fight it out. They're going to have the backing of all the other guilds. Do you think there's any chance they won't win or the agencies won't cave? What's going to happen here?
The agencies might not cave because, you know, they're owned by conglomerates and hedge funds now. And it would be a complete 180 from how they have been used to doing business. So
it's been 50 years now. Packaging is a 50-year, you know, practice.
Yeah, and essentially what you're saying is, thank you for investing in our business. Our business is no longer run the you know, you invested in a business that is no longer run in that way. So it would be a huge change. And so I don't necessarily...
But the writers, the actors, and the directors, the creative talent can just say, I'm getting a new agent. No, they don't.
Yeah, that doesn't always happen, okay? And if you look at Jodie Foster, you know, she's been around, she's had the same agent for 40 years and in the same publicist.
People
the same
dump them constantly. People dump their agents and their managers every day. Every time they get a hit, they fire. It pisses me off. I'd love to see more loyalty like that. And there is loyalty, but you know what? They're not going to support their guilds. You think Jodie Foster isn't going to support SAG and WGA and the Directors Guild in this battle? I think she will.
It'll be interesting. Where is the reporting saying that the writers are going to back the Writers Guild?
I'm just assuming that the actors and the directors and everyone is going to agree with the writers because they're all suffering the same thing. They're seeing their agents and their managers, you know, nickel and dime them to death, and you have all these conflicts of interest. They've been going on for so long, and now they're finally saying enough is enough. It was bad enough when our managers were doing it. Now the agents are doing it, and it's got to end. It's going to be a radical rechanging of the industry. It's going to have to be strikes or something. I don't know what's going to go on, but you know, this isn't like a little, hey, we want 8% and you want to give us 6%. This is a fundamental change to what agents and managers have been doing for decades. So this is a real, real big fight.
Yeah, and remember, there was that issue, okay, back when Michael Ovitz, who used to run CAA, then he went to Disney and ran Disney for a year and walked off with $120 million after being fired. And then he started his own agency, his own management firm, and started hiring away agents from CAA and some of the other agencies. And Creative Artists Agency said, whoa, 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 whoa. You're acting as an agent, and you're not allowed to do that, okay? You're either a manager and you're not finding work for your clients. We're doing that. And you're guiding their careers, which is what you're supposed to be doing. And yes, because of that, that allows you to be a producer on their projects, or you're an agency and you're finding work for them, which is what we do. And that came to a head, and it kind of put Michael Ovitz out of business, along with several other reasons. But that was one of the key reasons.
I can't see this being anything other than a knockdown, drag out, ugly fight. You know, they've started the battle. They said, look, we're not going to resign in 12 months. This is it. We're fighting. And this is not a little nibbling around the edges. This is a fundamental challenge to what managers and agents do. And we'll have to see what happens. But it looks very serious to me.
Yeah, I almost want to predict this won't be the last time we talk about it.
Yeah, well, it can't be. Of course not.
Yeah.
It won't be the last time we talk about people dying either, unfortunately. And in two of the cases, it's possibly and probably suicide. Vern Troyer, the actor who played Mini-Me in the Austin Power movies, died at 49. He'd been struggling for years with depression and alcohol addiction and other issues. And while they did not reveal the cause of death, a statement on his Facebook page said that depression and suicide are very serious issues. So obviously you can draw your conclusions from that sad comment by them. And the same applies to Swedish DJ artist Avicii. He died at 28. And it seemed like he really was taking the right steps to turn his life around. I mean, you know, sometimes we look at Amy Winehouse and other people, and you and I are saying, I hope somebody around this person will help them and, you know, let them know they can say no and step away. And that's what Avicii did. He said, I cannot handle touring. I just end up drinking too much. He had major health issues around excessive drinking, but he stopped touring. He went back home. He tried to refine some balance in his life, but it didn't work, and he committed suicide.
Yeah, I didn't realize that he was having issues. I had no idea. I mean, I knew his music, but I didn't know that he was in dire straits.
Yeah, and have you ever been to Burning Man?
I have never been to Burning Man because it's always over like Labor Day. I've always wanted to go, but now it's kind of a thing. So I feel like it would be like going to Coachella. Well, I do go to Coachella, but I went before it was Coachella.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're too cool for school. Well, Larry Harvey, one of the founders of Burning Man, died at 1970. He died at the age of 70. He founded it in 1986 with his friend Jerry James. They did not want it to be a festival. They wanted it to be a community. That's what they hoped for a good long time. I think that's sort of what they achieved. He suffered a major stroke on April 4th and never recovered. You know, Burning Man is still kind of a funky odd thing. It seems it's certainly a lot more commercial and organized, but I think at some point you get so big, you just have to be organized or it will implode. So I think they decided, well, we want to keep it going, so we're going to make some compromises, but I think they've still tried to keep the spirit of Burning Man alive. Whether they've succeeded or not is better said by people who actually go, I guess.
I would imagine you're right, but you're actually listening to our show and we appreciate that.
Especially if you rate and review us.
Yes, on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Please rate and review the show. It does help us out. You can find those ways to subscribe on showbizsandbox.com, our website. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Their new album is out now, and their world tour returns to the U.S. on May 7th, so on Sunday. The first stop, Denver, Colorado. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's I Heart Milk Tea.
Oh,
that's the director. Yes. The Taiwanese, that's her nickname. Oh. I like milk tea as well, but you know, I like milk tea. Oh. Go milk tea.
Okay. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you have to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.